Thank you, Martin. Well, we're in chapter 20, and we've come to verse 5. Chapter 20 and verse 5. Words of David. Section headed, David and Jonathan formulate their plans. Tomorrow is the new moon. I should not fail to sit with the king at meat. Apart from all the many other sacrifices and offerings which Israel made to the Lord, monthly burnt offerings were required at the appearance of every new moon. Numbers 28, in the beginning of your months, that's the new moon, ye shall offer a burnt offering unto the Lord. This is the burnt offering of every month throughout the months of the year. The occasion was celebrated with on God's insistence, with a sacrificial meal. And the occasion of this new moon, accompanied by celebration and great rejoicing. Numbers 10, in the day of your gladness and in your solemn days, in the beginning of your months, ye shall blow with the trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings. They shall be to you for a memorial before your God. Psalm 81. Sing aloud to God our strength. Make a joyful noise to the God of Jacob. Take a psalm, bring a timbrel, the pleasant harm and psaltery. King James Bible. Blow up the trumpet. I don't think really they meant to detonate the thing. Perhaps we'll say, blow the trumpet in the new moon, in the time appointed on your solemn feast day, for this was a statute for Israel, a law of the God of Jacob. It was a time of great rejoicing, one of those occasions in the calendar when God's presence and praise was marked by joy and gladness. I came across, a little while ago, perhaps 2 years ago now, something like that, a published tribute paid to one believer, came from Germany, and what it said was this: Harry proved that for people who know and trust Jesus, being dull and boring is optional. And I thought it was marvelous, really, this whole idea of joy and gladness in the life of the Christian. Well, this day on which the monthly offering was made was observed also as a day of rest. Hear this, I'm in Amos 8. Hear this, ye that swallow up the needy, even to make the poor of the land to fail, saying, when will the new moon be gone that we may sell corn, and the Sabbath that we may set forth wheat? Now, Saul had taken full advantage of this. He was going along with this, very much so, and had made the offering an occasion of a family festival lasting in full 2 days, as verse 27 makes clear. Now, David would have, in the normal course of events, been there. He would be expected to be there, not only because he's Saul's son-in-law, a close family member, but he was also one of Saul's highest-ranking military commanders. So there would be no question that everybody would have looked to see David in his place. Let me go, he says, that I may hide myself in the field unto the third day at even. That is, clearly, until the monthly two-day celebration that Saul was following was over. Verse 6. Say, David earnestly asked leave of me, that he might run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. Now, Saul, David asked Jonathan to explain to Saul that David's absence could actually be easily explained, that he had been called to go quickly, you note the word run, to his own family festival. David's desire to participate in an annual sacrifice with his family wouldn't in itself have normally be considered unusual. In more stable times, and these were anything but stable, such sacrifices as the annual sacrifice would have been offered at the central sanctuary and nowhere else. If you'd started the book, if we'd read from the beginning, we'd have met the man Elkanah and all his house, who, verse 21 of chapter 1, went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice. And again, Samuel's mother, in chapter 2, verse 19, made him a little coat, brought it to him from year to year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. You would not have done it at home, you would have done it around the central sanctuary. And during Samuel's boyhood days, the venue for that sacrifice was at Shiloh. 1 Samuel 1 tells you that. That's not made up. It was the site of the tabernacle, there labeled in verse 24, the house of the Lord. And God required that all sacrifices to him be offered at the central sanctuary. Deuteronomy 12. There shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. Thither shall he bring all that I command you, burnt offerings, sacrifices, tithes, heave offering of your hand, and all your choice vows which he vowed to the Lord. There was no room to maneuver in stable days. But by David's time, the Ark of the Covenant had been, in one sense, lost. It had been, not lost because they didn't know where it was, but it had been removed from the tabernacle. Shiloh itself had apparently been destroyed. There's no question whether it was destroyed. The only very slight question is whether it had yet been destroyed. And the tabernacle at Shiloh ceased to be the focal point for all sacrifice and offering. So apart from a long list of references in the book of Jeremiah, which are relevant, which I won't go into, I just take the end of Psalm 78, which says, he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he had placed among men. God forsook it. He delivered his strength, a reference to the ark, into captivity, his glory, into the enemy's hand. Now, in such an unsettled state, it seems from this passage and others that the annual sacrifices, along with the rest, were offered in a worshipper's hometown. Now, clearly there was an altar of the Lord already at Bethlehem, because the Lord had simply told Samuel to take an heifer with him and say, I am come to sacrifice to the Lord. He didn't need to build an altar. There was one there. Was David telling Jonathan to lie for him? Well, either David was, in which case one would assume he regarded this fabrication about the annual feast as a justifiable deception in the circumstances, in which case we'd have to say he was wrong to lie, that is. Doesn't matter how difficult the circumstances are, truth is truth. Or he really did go to Bethlehem, as he had said to Jonathan he was to tell Saul, and that then he subsequently returned in time to hide in the field. Jonathan's words in verse 19 suggest that that latter explanation's the right one. When thou hast stayed 3 days, then go down quickly and come to the place where thou didst hide thyself when the business was in hand. That is, I think, the agreed schedule was that David would run to Bethlehem to share in the annual family meal, and then return quickly is the word, to take up his hiding place toward the south of the field by this stone Ezel. If that is right, you need just to look again at a few verses and perhaps rethink their meaning. So David's earlier words to Jonathan, that I may hide myself in the field unto the third day at evening, would have to mean that he promised to be back at the field by the evening of the third day. And the statement of verse 24, he hid himself in the field, would be looking forward in time to when David had returned in accordance with Jonathan's directions. I think myself it highly unlikely, apart from any issues of what the text says, that David would have hung out in a field for 3 days. So personally, I believe he did exactly what he was telling Jonathan to tell Saul he would do. Verse 7. If he say thus, it is well, thy servant shall have peace. But if he be wroth, then be sure that evil is determined by him. David's suggestion that Jonathan excuse his absence from Saul's feast by an attendance at the yearly family sacrifice at Bethlehem was well calculated to expose and uncover Saul's true feelings and intentions. Because if, as David believed, Saul was intent on killing him, having now revealed his hand in chapter 19, gone public on it, then he would no doubt take the first opportunity to eliminate David. He had nothing to lose. If David managed to evade him now, the king had no idea when he would get his next opportunity. But any frustration on Saul's part at David's absence and escape would show, it must show, the more so if, as did happen, and I guess David would expect to happen, Jonathan spoke out on his behalf. David's absence would therefore be a good litmus test. It would be a good test of Saul's intention toward him. I don't think for a moment it was that David saw any likelihood at all in Saul responding, it is well, no problem, proving that David was back in his good books. David's proposal was aimed at provoking Saul to some angry outburst before Jonathan, to convince Jonathan of how things really were. I guess David didn't foresee how helpful in a way that meeting would be and how it would provide him with the answer to his questions about why it was Saul was at what he was. But we'll get to it. Verse 8. Thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant, for thou hast brought thy servant into a covenant of the Lord with thee. It was a covenant of the Lord, not because it was made between them and the Lord, but because it had been ratified by both of them in the name of the Lord, by a solemn oath. It was, of course, an expression of their mutual love for one another. And in terms of sequence, their love for each other, their mutual love, had expressed itself in this solemn covenant into which they'd entered, and to which they could forever, either and both of them, refer back to the security afforded by that covenant. They could appeal to it, as both David and Jonathan do throughout the chapter. Not only here in verse 8, but verses 14, 15, 23, and 42. David expects Jonathan to deal kindly with it, to act with kindness. This is the quite normal word for love, for loving kindness, for perhaps best steadfast love. He expects that of him because of the covenant, even though David sees himself as, at this point, the lesser and needy partner in the covenant. You might notice how he refers to himself as your servant 3 times. But similarly, Jonathan, who was clearer in his mind than David was at the moment, could see the long-term prospects for David, and so seeks assurances from David for his part that he will show kindness to him, that he will show steadfast love to him and to his seed. Verses 14 and 15. So both David and Jonathan are looking to the other to demonstrate covenant loyalty. If there be in me iniquity, slay me thyself. Why shouldst thou bring me to thy father? If I have to die, Jonathan, then I would rather far die by the hand of a friend than at the hand of a man who regards me and treats me as his enemy. Verse 10. Who shall tell me? Remember, we're at Saul's court, probably Gibeah. Well, who in that court, David wondered, could actually be trusted to inform him of the outcome? What if thy father answer thee roughly, which I would probably translate, if what your father answers you is harsh, that is, it is unfavorable to me. Verse 11, Jonathan said to David, come and let us go out into the field. Now they are at Saul's court. And in spite of Saul's personal absence, there were enormous risks that they could be overheard by some official who was either sympathetic to the king or lived in mortal terror of him. And so Jonathan proposed that they pursue this discussion in a safe and isolated place. His purpose in going into the field is to talk openly with his covenant brother, to assure David of his loyalty to him and agree the terms, the details of the terms, on how information can be exchanged and, if necessary, David protected from the wrath of Saul. And it stands just in terms of the words, in stark contrast with Cain's actions back at the beginning of the book, the Bible, toward his natural brother in a field. Cain talked with Abel, his brother. It came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. Same word here, slay me thyself. Jonathan proposed to go into a field to save his covenant brother from being slain. A nice contrast there. Verses 12 and 13, Jonathan said to David, as you just read the text through, O Lord God of Israel, and clearly you must supply something, and in all likelihood, given other passages, you supply the words, be witness, which would, in the context, though not said, would have been understood both by David and Jonathan. So I'd stick with the New American Standard here. The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness when I have sounded out. As he hath been with my father. What's the tense there? It's sad. There's a pathos about this. Whether Jonathan really realized it or not, and perhaps he did, the Lord, in terms of his presence and blessing, was no longer with Saul. Saul realized it. You realize it. We had it in chapter 18, verse 12. The Lord was departed from Saul, but once he'd been with him, may he be with you as once he was with my father. Verses 14 and 15. Thou shalt not only while yet I live show me the kindness of the Lord, that I die not. Thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. Jonathan expects that at some point David will be king. Normally, when any new regime or dynasty came to power, then purge was the name of the game. Normal practice, ancient Near East, for any king who begins a new dynasty to play safe and eliminate all descendants of the former king to prevent them from rising up, staging a coup, and reclaiming the throne. And you've only got to look at the history, particularly of Israel, but on one occasion of Judah, to get your examples. You don't need to raid the literature of the ancient Near East. Your Bible will do this for you. Baasha, Zimri, Jehu, and Queen Athaliah, to mention just a handful. And life expectancy was very short. If you happened to be a relative of an outgoing monarch, you didn't buy green bananas. As a prominent member of the existing royal house, and he was, like Saul, Jonathan, his firstborn. It was natural enough that Jonathan would be concerned about his future prospects, but not his only, his seed. It was the very same concern which later Saul expressed and led him to seek and to obtain an assurance from David in terms of his seed and house. In chapter 24, following the sparing in the cave bit, "Swear now therefore to me by the Lord, thou shalt not cut off my seed after me, that thou wilt not destroy my name out of my father's house." Of course, the ancients laid great store on the continuation of their name down through the years. Now, for his part, Jonathan was able to rest and to plead, to rest on the covenant between David and himself, which, of course, Saul wasn't. He didn't have any covenant. But Jonathan, I suggest, realized as well that the terms of their existing covenant would need to be refined and extended, because the covenant into which they both entered in chapter 18, if my interpretation of 18 was right, you might remember that, if it was a covenant between them both rather than just Jonathan pledging himself, then that covenant into which they'd entered would need to be extended, because the 18 covenant was a covenant between them as individuals. What Jonathan is talking about now is a covenant between two houses, between two dynasties, a covenant extended to David's descendants and his descendants, and that in perpetuity, forever, verse 15. Between me and thee forever, verse 23. Between my seed and thy seed forever, verse 42. Might like to compare a case from the book of Genesis. Abimelech and Phicol, who requested something along the same lines from Abraham concerning their descendants, in the light of the fact that God was with him. A lot of correspondences here, you know. Abimelech and Phicol, chief captain of his host, spake to Abraham, saying, "God is with thee in all thou doest. Now therefore swear unto me here by God, thou wilt not deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor with my son's son, but according to the kindness that I have done to thee, so shalt thou do unto me." Subsequent history showed that Jonathan actually had nothing to fear. David was an honorable man. And when he became king, went out of his way, actually actively took steps to honor this covenant with Jonathan. We know what was going to happen, but David didn't. And he asked, "Is there yet any that is left of the house of Saul?" The house of Saul. "That I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake. Show him steadfast love." The king said, I mean 2 Samuel 9. The king said, "Is there yet any that I may of the house of Saul, that I may show the kindness of God unto him?" Repeats it. And then David said to him, "Mephibosheth, fear not," because he had every reason to fear, naturally. "I will surely show thee kindness for Jonathan thy father's sake." You might notice that verbal connection, the kindness of the Lord in my chapter, and the kindness of God, 2 Samuel 9. References to the fact that the covenant between these two men was made before God. He was the witness to their solemn pledge. And then following that famine which came on Israel, which resulted, the famine which came on Israel as a result of Saul's slaughter of the Gibeonites, and David has to sort the thing out. He spoke to Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul, which comes out in 2 Samuel 21. You've nothing to worry about with David. "Not cut off thy kindness when the Lord hath cut off the enemies." Not much doubt, is there? It's a deliberate play on Jonathan's part on that word translated cut off. The writer, the narrator, actually carries that on for him into verse 16, telling us that Jonathan cut a covenant, using exactly the same word. When the Lord hath cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth. I find, Jonathan wouldn't, but I find something sad in that. You got Jonathan's unqualified confidence, first of all, that in God's time, this was going to happen. It's not an if, it's a when. And it's not a some or lot of, it's every one of God's enemies. But little did Jonathan suspect when he said it, that it was his own father who had so recently spoken to his sister about David as his enemy. And so it was that when on Gilboa, the Philistines cut off, same word, Saul's head, the man who had declared David to be among his enemies was himself cut off by the Lord, as if he had been one of David's. He wasn't. David would never have signed up to that. But he was cut off as if he had been. Verse 16. Let the Lord even require it at the hand of David's enemies. Gulp. What does that mean? I'm not altogether sure what Jonathan had in mind. He seems to be wishing that any who broke the covenant which was made between him and David would share the fate of David's enemies, that is, of being cut off, previous verse. Got in front of me two interpretations offered by the older commentators. The more recent commentators tend to ignore it. Always the safest thing to do if you don't understand it. First of all, I quote, "The Lord require it at the hand of David's seed, for of David himself he had no suspicion, if they prove so far David's enemies as to deal wrongfully with the posterity of Jonathan." Now, that's stretching it a bit, but you know, you've got David's descendants who, because David really wanted to deliver the house of Jonathan, that if any of his own descendants violate this covenant, then they have proved themselves David's enemies in reality. Well, that may, you know, it's a bit hard going. Coming at it the other way, with a lot more plausibility, take vengeance on Jonathan or any of his posterity, should they break this covenant by showing themselves enemies to David. So Jonathan would be saying, you can trust me on this, because my wish before God is that even if my descendants should break this covenant and prove themselves your enemies, may they be destroyed. He may have, in a way, bridged both of those. His desire may be for God's judgment to fall on any of his or David's descendants. You just note that descendants bit again. The covenant is made not with David personally, but with, watch the language, it is loaded, the house of David. That echoes through the Old Testament prophets, the house of David. But that God's judgment might fall on any, his descendants or David's, who presumed to violate the covenant which he and David had made in such solemn terms before God. Verses 18 and 19. Thou shalt remain by the stone Ezel. Literally, you shall sit by the stone Ezel. Another word play. Instead of taking his seat at Saul's table, verse 18, David was to sit by the stone Ezel. I don't know anything about the stone. It clearly was a well-known landmark. I don't suppose you go much further. It is formed the name, which probably has some significance. They did those things in those days. The name is formed from the very simple verb to go. So it might signify, for instance, a stone of demarcation, marking the boundary between someone's property. It could be, quote, sort of translation, a stone of departure. Maybe this was given the name later as a memorial of this parting between David and Jonathan. Maybe it was a very simple roadstone, a kind of signpost, telling people which direction to go. I don't know. Does it matter? Verse 20, it might matter. I don't know. Verse 20, Jonathan proposes a form of signal system between him and David. Why? It really is undercover stuff, isn't it? Cloak and dagger. They can't rely on having a future personal meeting. Everything will depend on circumstances. There must be a safe signal. Jonathan, brilliant idea. I will shoot 3 arrows. A well-chosen sign and indicator, because this man was famed for his archery skills. Remember how David singles out Jonathan's bow for mention in his great eulogy at the beginning of 2 Samuel 1. He even named the eulogy after Jonathan's bow. He told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow, so there would be no suspicion, even on Saul's part, if Jonathan should choose to go off on some archery practice. It was brilliant. Verses 21 and 2. The young boy sent to find the arrows would be told either that the arrows were on this side of him or that they were beyond him. Jonathan was sufficiently proficient with his bow that he would be able to direct the arrows wherever he wanted. In the former case, David would know that everything was well. Could come back, he was safe. Which is exactly what Jonathan hoped and even expected to happen. In that case, the way was clear for David to re-enter the royal court. But if the arrows were beyond the boy, then David would know his life was in real danger and he would go. Verse 22. The Lord hath sent thee away. What a godly man this is. Jonathan recognized that if things turned out this way, it was the Lord's will for David to become a fugitive and leave Saul's court for good. Verse 23. The Lord be between thee and me forever. Jonathan invoking the Lord as witness between them. This is very common language in the Old Testament. And go back to an ancient agreement between Jacob and Laban. You can go back that far. Laban said to Jacob, "Behold this heap, behold this pillar, which I have cast between me and thee. This heap be witness, this pillar witness, that I will not pass over this heap to thee. Thou shalt not pass over this heap and pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham and God of Nahor, judge betwixt us." Well, then we come to the section from verse 24 down. Takes us to verse 34. And Jonathan is put very much in the picture. The section opens with David's place empty, verses 24 and 5, and closes with Jonathan's place empty, verse 34. The section has actually got a very well-balanced structure, breaking down into 2 subsections where the principal characters reverse their roles. So the first bit, the first stage, you get a question from Saul, "Wherefore comest not?" verse 27. You have a response and a revelation by Jonathan, verses 28 and 9, and you've got the anger of Saul, verse 30 and 31. But that then moves on to stage 2, where you have a question from Jonathan, "Wherefore shall he?" followed by response and revelation by Saul, verse 33, and terminates with the anger of Jonathan. So actually, the Spirit of God has sort of set this in parallel, and they just reverse their roles through it. Verse 24 and 25. The king sat upon his seat, which is a good place to sit, as at other times even upon a seat by the wall. It was clearly Saul's practice to sit by the wall, partly, I guess, because the seat of honor would have been located immediately opposite the entrance to the room, and partly because, frankly, it was the safest place to sit, safe from attack behind, no knives in the back stuff, because you've got your back to the wall. The wall was not always the safest place if people are throwing spears, but we'll come to that. Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side. Now, it looks to me from the wording there that when Abner, who was no unimportant character, he is Saul's cousin, yeah, he is commander-in-chief of his army, wow, he is also his, seemingly, his personal principal bodyguard. When Abner walked in, Jonathan resigned his seat next to Abner, next to Saul, for Abner to take it. That seems to be what it's saying. And Jonathan sat down somewhere else, within easy speaking distance of his father, of course, and still at the table, verse 34, because he arose from it. Whether he had any grounds for it, I don't know. I guess he didn't. But Josephus reports the seating arrangement rather differently. On the next day, which was the new moon, the king, when he'd purified himself, as the custom was, came to supper. And when there sat by him his son Jonathan on his right hand, and Abner, the captain of his host, on the other hand, he saw David's seat was empty and said nothing. So Josephus saw them sitting, one on his right hand and one on his left hand, which, just even to use the words, conjures up, I'm sure, in most of your minds, an incident in the New Testament when the two very ambitious disciples coveted the right and left hand seats in our Lord's manifested kingdom, which they thought and believed he was about to establish at Jerusalem. They were deaf to everything he said. They had their own agenda based on Old Testament text, in fairness to them, but ignoring a lot of Old Testament text as well. And they, as far as they were concerned, were on the road to Jerusalem, and when they got there, he'd sit on his throne. And it's a question of which of the 12 would sit on his right and left hand. When Jesus asked James and John, "What would you that I should do for you?" they said, "Grant to us we may sit one on thy right hand, the other on thy left hand, in thy glory." But boy, were they glad that the Lord declined their request to have places at his right hand and his left hand at Jerusalem. One of them, at least, was there to see that with him they crucified two thieves or malefactors, the one on his right hand, the other on his left, and the scripture was fulfilled. He was numbered with the transgressors. No, thank you. The right and left hand of Jesus at Jerusalem was not something to covet. Verse 26, Saul spake not anything that day, for he thought, something hath befallen him. He's not clean, surely. He is not clean. You can see him trying to persuade himself here. It wasn't difficult, nor was it unusual for men and women too, perhaps even more so women, in Israel to contract ceremonial defilement. If, for instance, somebody simply touched, came into contact with a dead body, human or animal, they were unclean. And if they were, inverted commas, unclean, they were forbidden to partake of any religious feasts or any sacred food. Verse 27 and 8, on the morrow. Well, that explanation stood for the first day. But although ceremonial uncleanness would cause someone to miss a religious feast, such as a new moon, in almost all cases, uncleanness only lasted for a single day. You've got a formula, a refrain, that runs through Leviticus and Numbers. Unclean until the even. 26 times you find it. Unclean until the even. And I notice from Leviticus 22 in particular what's said about the priest who touched something unclean. I quote, "He shall be unclean until even. He shall not eat of the holy things. When the sun is down, he shall be clean, and shall afterward eat of the holy things." So the principle seems to be that if You went through one of a whole score of circumstances and situations which it wasn't sinful, but you would actually become ceremonially, ritually unclean. You could not participate in any religious feast. But Saul on day two now realizes that this explanation with which he had previously satisfied himself cannot be correct. So he asked, "Wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to meat, neither yesterday nor today?" Now, I wrestle a little bit with the extent to which, if at all, Saul meant to insult David by speaking of him as the son of Jesse. On the one hand, I know that David spoke of himself that way. In his last words, you will read, and you sort of file these away as I say them, and you'll see the weakness. "David, the son of Jesse," said, "the man that was raised up on high, anointed of the God of Jacob, the sweet psalmist of Israel." And when Amasai, good man as he was, addressed David, 1 Chronicles 12, "the spirit came on Amasai, chief of the captains," he said, "thine are we, David, on thy side, thou son of Jesse. Peace, peace unto thee." So, title son of Jesse didn't necessarily mean you had been disparaged. But, and it's a massive but, I'd like you just to notice the following. First of all, in those cases and others like them, the words son of Jesse are linked with David as his personal name. Secondly, of course, you remember David was Saul's son-in-law. Saul had previously used David's personal name when communicating about him back in chapter 16. That when he was feeling warmly inclined toward David, with every reason to be so, he would address him as "my son David," which happened both in chapter 24 and 26. That Saul seemingly often used the word son of, when he was angry with somebody. In the next chapter, "son of Ahitub." Even Jonathan gets his "son of" form of address here in verse 30. When Jonathan refers to David, he speaks of him by name, verse 28. Weighing it all up, I could be wrong, it seems to me that Saul just could not bring himself at this point to use his proper name. And that he did use this title, son of Jesse, in a somewhat disparaging sense. It was a mild form of insult. Perhaps he's saying, "that son of that old sheep farmer Jesse," underlining David's lowly family background. Jonathan answered Saul, "David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem." In reporting those words to us, the writer may have engaged in a very gentle wordplay. There are lots around. This could be another. David would prefer to celebrate with his humble family in Bethlehem, house of bread, than risk coming to partake of the king's lahem, his meat or bread or food in general, which is what it means, maybe. Verse 29. "My brother, he hath commanded me to be there." Now, there's nothing implausible, and it probably was true even, in pressure coming from one of his brothers, I guess Eliab as the eldest. Jesse was a man of greatly advanced age, as we've already spotted. I note that the story that is relayed to Saul speaks of David not being invited or called, but commanded, charged, ordered to attend the sacrifice. And yet, as Jonathan puts it to Saul, as the story goes, David had nevertheless very courteously sought and obtained permission before going from Saul's firstborn. Well, there's no problem, Saul is saying, about David being missing. I don't understand the fuss. The explanation is as simple as that. But as Jonathan was soon to find out, it was certainly a problem to Saul. Verse 30, Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. The result of David's proposed test turned out just as he had expected. Saul raged like a lion, disappointed of its prey. He had clearly been counting on this new moon festival to give him the opportunity he wanted to be rid of his rival, as he deemed him, once and forever. How different his rage, his anger now, to that with which he began his role as king. Back in chapter 11, I quote, "The Spirit of God came on Saul when he heard these tidings. His anger was kindled greatly, and he went out to perform a remarkable exploit for God and his people." He was angry back in chapter 11, but it is what we label a righteous anger. Remember with the Lord himself in Mark 3, man there in the synagogue with a withered hand, and the critics were there watching. Would he do anything? Would he dare do anything on the Sabbath? When he had looked round about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their heart, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." Didn't touch him. They couldn't have him. They couldn't pin anything on him. He was angry. And I think it's right to say it's a poor day indeed when the injustices, declining moral standards around us don't at times make us angry. Have I been angry in the recent past about something which I should be angry about? Or am I so pathetically indifferent these things cease to make me angry? But look at Saul now. He's not doing the will of God now as he was in chapter 11. He is setting himself against the will of God. He's the servant of God working salvation, which is what chapter 11 says, salvation. But he's a slave to his own malice, planning only destruction. If not of David or Jonathan, then most certainly of himself, as we covered in the last session. I note that if there is no mention of the Spirit of God here, as there was in chapter 11, neither is there any mention of the spirit of distress, as there was at the time of the casting of his spear, both in chapter 18 and 19. You can now take it. You'll not read of that spirit of distress again. Saul's own envy and hatred are enough in themselves. They have taken over. The man is being eaten away. "Thou son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion, to the confusion of thy mother's nakedness?" So before he gets round to hurling his spear at Jonathan, he first hurls his insults, and they were pretty nasty insults. It was very hard, probably well nigh impossible, for an Oriental to imagine anything worse, anything more offensive, than to speak in a vulgar way about somebody's mother. Saul speaks of Jonathan's mother, presumably Ahinoam, as perverted, that is, bent, twisted, and warped, and rebellious. And by speaking with such venom about Jonathan's mother, Saul is deliberately turning up the heat, intensifying his insult to the extreme. "To thine own confusion or shame," which probably means that in choosing to befriend David, in supporting his cause, you are paving the way for Jonathan to become king and so to displace you. And in Saul's book, only an imbecile would do that. It was therefore to Jonathan's own shame and the confusion or shame of your mother's nakedness. A euphemistic reference, of course, to Jonathan's conception and birth. I don't know what he exactly meant. It's probably one of two things. that number one, which is the tamest, that it was a dreadful humiliation for this young man's, not young, it's a dreadful humiliation for Jonathan's mother to have borne such a worthless son who would fail to ever fulfill the royal role to which he had been born. His birth had been wasted. It had all been in vain, maybe. Or, with even more venom, that Jonathan's actions would lead men to conclude that he had no royal blood in his veins after all, that if the truth was told, he was illegitimate, his mother a loose, immoral woman. In other words, your conduct, son, argues persuasively, I am not your father. If I was, you wouldn't behave like this, loving a man I hate. And all this you would do for your own sake. Verse 31. As long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Saul clearly feels he needs to spell this out almost syllable for his dense son. And I imagine this man with bulging veins and red face roaring at his stupid son, the only three words in the whole world that should have mattered to Jonathan. You and your kingdom. Because although Saul left it unsaid, the only three words that mattered to Saul in the whole world were me and my kingdom. Which raises for luckless Malcolm the obvious but red-hot question. What matters most to me? A case of me and my kingdom, or God and his kingdom? Which do I seek first? Saul spoke entirely in terms of the threat which David posed to Jonathan and to his kingdom. That's the implication of what Samuel had said to Saul back in chapter 13, thy kingdom shall not continue. But Saul knew full well from the sequel in chapter 15 that David also posed a very real threat to him personally. The Lord has rent the kingdom of Israel from thee. But though it is that which at least in part and perhaps in the main drove him, of that he said nothing, just left the impression that his only concern really was for Jonathan. Jonathan, his only concern for his son that he's prepared to pin to the wall with his spear? But although Jonathan's father probably has said less than he really means, he has said enough. He is unmasked. Now Jonathan understands, at least in part, his reason for wanting David dead. Saul sees David as the menace to the dynasty. Now send and fetch him to me, for he shall surely die. Now we've been reading through this. We hear clear echoes from chapter 19, and Saul's words, when believing David to be sick, he'd expressed his willingness to kill David personally. Saul sent, same word as here, messengers to take, King James, to fetch, same word as here. David, he sent messengers again, saying, bring him to the bed that I may slay, same word as die here. They just run in parallel. Saul is clearly convinced that Jonathan does know David's whereabouts, so he can send and fetch him, which underscores for the reader the wisdom of those elaborate precautions, which may have seemed over the top at the time, that Jonathan had proposed to keep David's hiding place secret. He shall surely die. Literally, he is a son of death. Please don't take that as a translation. It is the literal translation, but it's overdone. He is a person who deserves to die. But you can say that from Saul's point of view, this son of Jesse is also a son of death. You'd see that if you were reading Hebrew text. This particular idiom, son of death, only is found twice else in the Old Testament, both in the books of Samuel. On both other occasions, it comes from the lips of David, following on that, as the Lord liveth, as here. It is found in the words of David to Abner, as the Lord liveth, you are worthy to die, you are a son of death, you are his bodyguard, we slipped through the line, we could have stuck the spear in his chest, you are a son of death. And then, far more important for us, in David's word to Nathan, in 2 Samuel 12, as the Lord liveth, the man that hath done this thing shall surely die. The man that has done this thing is a son of death. And it's that last occurrence, spoken as here, in the heat of anger, which would haunt David for the rest of his life. For the prophet immediately swung on him and identified David himself to be that son of death. Thou art the man. And so one day, these words of Saul would become true. David would be rightly a son of death, one worthy to die. But it's not true now. And Jonathan's not slow to challenge Saul about his words. Verse 32. Wherefore shall he be slain? What hath he done? Now, if the king had hoped that his straight speaking and taunts would have roused some envy in Jonathan's heart, instilling in his son the poison that has been working in his own heart for so long, he is very soon disabused, sorely disappointed. That's spelled S-O-R-E-L-Y, nothing to do with his name. Jonathan responds, not only by taking David's side against his father, but confronting Saul with the injustice of what he's attempting to do, challenging him to produce evidence. His question, what hath he done, is a straight verbal echo of David's question to him. He's just relaying it on. What have I done? And Jonathan now stands and looks Saul in the eye and fires that very question at him. What has he done? Verse 33, Saul cast a javelin at him to smite him. Now Saul is really mad. He grips his spear, always at hand, and hurls it at Jonathan. That is his answer. At him. At the very same man whose future prosperity and well-being Saul had claimed only a few moments before was his reason for wanting to kill David. He is not behaving rationally, neither is he throwing accurately. Fortunately for Jonathan, his aim hasn't improved since those futile attempts to nail David to the wall. So in one sense, we can say with a sigh of relief, Jonathan didn't get the point. But in another, and far more important sense, he most certainly did. There was no doubt any longer in the good man's mind. Jonathan knew it was determined of his father to slay David. Jonathan is convinced now David's right. He's heard, he's seen the evidence for himself. And he's seen it in a context when there is no indication of the temporary madness and violence that he's seen in the past, often associated with in some way that spirit of distress that came on his father. He rose from the table in fierce anger. Verse 34. If Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, verse 30 it was, now it is Jonathan's anger that glows hot in verse 34. And now Saul has got two empty places at his table. And he did eat no bread the second day of the month. This noble son of Saul rises to fast, not to lead some rebellion against the king, as once did a less noble son of David. He was grieved for David, because his father had done him shame. His greatest concern at that moment is not the vile slur and insults that Saul has flung at him and even brought his mother into it. What incenses Jonathan is the public wrong that Saul has done David. What a magnificent character is Jonathan. Lord, make me more like that. Verses 35 to 42. The signal is given. Verse 35. A little lad. What's that bit? The boy who took the boy that Jonathan took with him to retrieve the arrows is specifically described as little. And it probably indicates that on this particular occasion, Jonathan took with him a younger lad than usual so that he wouldn't ask any embarrassing questions about any rather strange orders he was given or being capable of spotting anything unusual that happened and reporting it to others. I can't prove that, but there is an odd twist to this little lad here. Verses 36 to 38. Jonathan tells the boy to find the arrows he fired, one of which deliberately shot beyond him. When the lad reached, possibly neared the spot where the arrow landed, Jonathan called him back with the prearranged signal shout, "Is not the arrow beyond thee?" Now you might notice in verse 22 that Jonathan had originally intended or thought of shooting several arrows beyond the lad. But it does seem, and remember that Jonathan was a very good shot, in the event he felt he only needed one. That seems to be what happened. One, when he fired it, he could see it was exactly where he wanted it to go. Not that I would ever have doubted it. Not for a minute. Verse 39. The lad knew not anything. One of those instances in your Bible when it is essential that some character, usually a lesser character, who plays a key but seemingly unimportant role, does not know what's going on. A far more tragic example is of a certain noble Gittite warrior who once carried a sealed letter from his king to the commander of the forces, one Joab. Verse 40. Although the original plan had been for David to leave the scene immediately, if Saul told the young lad the arrows were beyond him, evidently Jonathan can see, which we can't, we have to accept it from him, that the coast was actually clear. So he felt it was safe to send the lad on his way and to speak with David face to face just once again. Now, his artillery here doesn't mean he's carrying a cannon with him, by the way. It's just a reference to his bow and quiver. Verse 41. Though both Jonathan and David were aware of God's purpose that David should be the future king, you notice how David shows respect to Jonathan. He is at this moment, by law, by title, the present king's son. David prostrates himself before Jonathan. David rises from his prostration, then to bow three times. It's just the sort of stuff that Abigail does in chapter 25 in the presence of the man that was to become king one day, and also her husband, but that's an awfully long story. David acceded. That is, although they are both weeping, David wept the most. Verse 42. How would you like to be in Jonathan's position at this moment? Lifting in some curious language of the King James Version from Philippians 1, he was very much in a strait betwixt two. He has that unhappy position of feeling the tug of two conflicting, competing loyalties. That of his covenant brother, that of his father and king, and chooses to submit to the domestic authority of his father and the civil authority of his king. Now, none of us can argue that it's wrong to honor one's father. The Lord of God said that. or to honor the king, Peter said that, was Jonathan wrong to do it now? To stay with Saul and let David go into rejection alone? The Bible's silent on the matter. It simply notes he went into the city. I'll stick with the Bible. David arose and departed. He knows what he needed to know. He knows what he didn't even expect, I suppose, to find out. He now knows he is legally an outlaw, a fugitive hunted by the king. And the two friends parted. For Jonathan's part, he believed that one day, now you think yourself into his head a moment, he believed one day that David would be king. And that when he became king, he, Jonathan, would be next to him. But he was also a realist. He knew there were no guarantees. For all he knew, he could even fall one day to his father's spear. You remember that earlier on, Saul had declared his suspicion that Jonathan had actually stirred up David against him. The man's mad. There's no knowing with Saul what he can do. So as far as Jonathan is aware, he might never see David again. Not because David will die. Not because there is a step between him and death. Not because God's word is in any way in question, but because he might die. And in fact, apart from one very brief meeting, great man as he was to seek it, this was the last time he ever saw David. For David's part, he heads off into the unknown. He's got nothing clear in his head at all beyond obtaining a few supplies and maybe a bit more from the priests at Nob and then seeking refuge. At least for a time, outside of Saul's territory, away on foreign ground. Did David wonder why? Why, if it is God's plan and purpose for him to be king, why all this? Why no shortcuts? I wonder how he would have felt if he could have seen ahead the hardships, the trials, the fears, the tears, the years that lay ahead of him. But whether David appreciated or not, and very few of us ever do, he is not yet ready. Not yet ready to be given rule over the Lord's people. His character needs to be formed, the gold of his faith to be refined. And so between him and his being made king over all Israel and Judah lay many hard times. No different today for the heirs of the kingdom. That's one from James. Who are one day to reign forever and ever. Do you believe that? To reign forever and ever, his servants, his bond slaves, shall worshipfully serve him. They shall see his face, his name will be in their foreheads, and they shall reign forever and ever. That's Revelation 22, verse 5. You'd think it came out of Alice in Wonderland. That's Revelation 22. You go back into Revelation 11. He shall reign forever and ever. Not any problem with that? Of course he shall reign forever and ever. But we shall reign with him. What's God predestined us to be conformed to the image of his son as we were singing Darby's hymn? We shall be like his son, we shall be with his son, and we shall reign with his son. But in the interval, now, have we the right to expect a smooth and easy, comfortable road any more than David? Not that we would expect to face what he did. Jonathan said to David, go in peace. Jonathan had earlier promised David that if it pleased his father to do David evil, then he, Jonathan, would send David away that he might go in peace. Verse 13. Well, we're in verse 42. But Jonathan is a man of his word. But given the circumstances in which they were spoken, Jonathan's words might have seen to any bystander, of which there were none. But if someone had been there and heard him say, go in peace, they would have said, this is totally incongruous. This is a joke. This is laughable. But they weren't incongruous, laughable words. Jonathan was right. David could go in peace. And so can we. Whatever our outward circumstances, it has nothing to do with it. My Lord told his disciples, in me ye have peace. In the world ye have tribulation. And in fact, I suppose if we were doing Greek text in these studies, I would just say, well, the emphasis falls there, in me, in the world. In me, peace. In the world. And they did. On a scale we know nothing about, they had tribulation. We do not have peace, my brothers, because everything around us or in our lives is peaceful. We have peace because a greater than Jonathan has pledged to us his unfailing friendship. In me, ye have peace. Right, session open, please, for comments. It's a long chapter.
I had a question regarding that the statement in verse 42. After Jonathan says, go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, The Lord will be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever. I mean, I remember the pictures of the splitting of the doves and the walking between and the sacrifice. Is this a similar kind of a covenant? But having the Lord go between, can you elaborate a little bit? I know that it's three or four times in this chapter.
Yes, it is. No, I don't think it is now, you know, we're not thinking of sacrificial victims and parts being divided and people passing through between them. I think it's an idiom, which is it's the way that you link the two parties together. The Lord, I'm going to find this difficult to express, that the Lord is the one who in a sense stands between them to guarantee that either party will get the benefits, reap the benefits of the covenant, and either party will be expected to deliver. I think the Lord sort of functions there in that way. I don't think it's a
witness, maybe?
Yes. Like I had to read the word witness in earlier on, as you saw, you know, that the, you know, when Jonathan speaks to David and says, oh Lord our God, Lord my God, or whatever it was, that he is the witness, he is the one who stands guarantor of this covenant, because they've invoked it in his name and before him. You know, so I understand it that way.
Could you go into what he meant whenever Jonathan made that statement in verse 16? Again, I know it's repetitive, but when he says,
then?
Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, right, let the Lord even require it at the hand of David's enemies.
Yeah.
He's not saying there, if you don't keep this covenant, or if your household doesn't keep this covenant in the future, may the enemies of your house triumph or bring it back on your head, right? He's saying something else entirely. That's what you were saying.
Yeah. What I did, which is cheating in a way, was to start with the commentators, you know, and say, well, you know, there are differing views here. The second one I quoted, which was actually from John Gill. As I say, these are very old commentators. He viewed it as Jonathan expressing the desire that the Lord would take vengeance on him and his own posterity if they broke the covenant and showed themselves to be enemies of David. In other words, if my descendants prove themselves to be as enemies, then treat them like enemies. Malcolm came back at that and said it could be that Jonathan actually went a bit further and embraced David's descendants as well. So he would be saying that whether it's your seed or my seed, my wish, my desire in this covenant would be that they, because they have betrayed a covenant between us, the heads, then whoever they are down there, let them meet the fate of your enemies. You know, like he talked about the enemies in verse 15, as you know, where, you know, what would happen to his enemies. And I think, because whichever way you go, you have to put things in a way to get out the meaning. But I think that what he was saying was, God's judgment on your enemies. It'll happen. Inevitably, it'll happen. I believe one day all your enemies will be destroyed. And as far as our covenant is concerned, as far as I am concerned in that covenant, whether it's your descendants or mine, if they transgress this covenant which you and I have made, then may God treat them like he treats your enemies. You know, it is a construction. I admit that. It doesn't actually say that. Sorry.
I just had a comment. At the very beginning of the chapter, when it points out the covenant between David, or this would be at, actually, I was thinking of 18, when he said that that Jonathan's soul was knit to David in love, and they made their covenant, and only because you won't get that far, I was thinking of Mephibosheth.
Yes.
And David asked over in 2 Samuel if there was yet any of the house of Saul that he could show the kindness of Saul, of Jonathan, for his sake.
Yep.
He never forgot the covenant. It doesn't say that David loved Jonathan, and yet in his actions he showed that he did.
Yes. No, that's right. The text always emphasizes in Jonathan's sort of soul love for David, but there is no question, you know, that David loved and committed himself to Jonathan.
And I have a question, too.
Oh, boy. I know your questions. Can I have notice, please?
I'll be quick.
No, it wasn't a length of them. I don't mind a length of them.
Okay. Jonathan's behavior in starting at, well, in the confrontation, I guess you'd call it, between Saul and Jonathan,
yep,
is really despicable. It really goes outside what is normal. I'm posing this as a question you'll see at the end. But what Jonathan does in public place, he really goes against his father, not only in the words that he expresses, but in his actions also. If this had been a man in Saul's court, he could have been put to death just for that, what he expressed, the anger and questioning Saul's judgment as king. And only because he is Saul's son, it looks to me like he is spared, even though Saul threw the spear at him, that was righteous. He was right because of what, this is what I'm asking. Okay, let me pose it as a question. For the type of relationship that existed between father and son at that time, and also because Saul was king, would you consider that right, that Saul was right because of the way that Jonathan questioned his judgment and his actions? He was right to put his son in a place of harm.
No, I didn't see it that way, really. I have to admit that if the word outrageous was used, I would have used it about Saul's conduct. I think Saul has forfeit any right to expect Jonathan just to go along with this. Like, what is Jonathan to do? For him not to speak up on David's behalf would really have been outrageous. He'd done it in chapter 19. It was not a problem then. Like, Saul had declared his intention to kill him. I know that was private. He was, you know, Jonathan was careful. But here, he's in a position where his father has let fly at him verbally, orderly, told him what he thinks and where his priorities should lie. You sort of rerun the video, don't you, that Jonathan had just started by the story. You know, that bit, there's nothing provocative in that. This is what David said to me. Very simple. I can explain his absence. At that point, his dad goes wild, you know, and starts throwing insults around. Jonathan, we know from the later verse, doesn't care what he says about him or himself. He'll even let pass the slur he cast on his mother. But Jonathan must speak up for David as he did before. He cannot let that go, even though it's in a public place. Now, I know that in the normal, that would have been an outrageous action to challenge a king publicly. But in the circumstances, you know, I fear what else can he do? And I just feel for the wall myself. It seems always to come off worst in these encounters. You know, it probably dreaded seeing Saul with a spear. The handyman who went round with the polyfiller or whatever it was must have had a field day in Saul's house.
Yeah, I are we finished? Are you finished?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes,
you know, my thoughts are, I'm struggling because I can't necessarily put them together, and there's a lot, but there is a sense in which you very clearly showed what an important chapter this is in the life of David, what a break, what a crossroads this is. And David has been manifested to the nation, Goliath and so on, and perhaps in chapter 20, for instance, in verse 1, as he goes to Jonathan, David's questions with Jonathan are not so much that David doesn't know what he's done. Perhaps it's that Jonathan, the questions are for Jonathan, like was mentioned about God going out to Abraham, where art thou? In other words, engaging Adam. And perhaps the questions are for Jonathan himself. Here's Jonathan, a believer within that establishment, a believer within Saul's system. And yet, at a critical juncture, that he himself has to be made aware of who David is and what the real issue at heart is. I say that, for instance, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but in Acts 21, even with Paul, when Paul gets to Jerusalem, and in Acts 21, the brethren there, he goes up to the brethren, and the brethren say to him, you know, they salute him, and they say, when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto Paul, thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they are all zealous of the law. And they are informed of thee that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses. In other words, they're asking Paul to take certain actions now. Mm-hmm. Actions that perhaps will reveal the very character of that Jewish establishment itself. So that those that are believing Jews still within that establishment can now begin to see things as they really are. I think of the Lord Jesus in John chapter 10. I am the door. I'm the door. Not the I'm the door. People need to come out. And other sheep I have which are not of this fold. In other words, David perhaps going to Jonathan himself. And this is David engaging Jonathan because Jonathan, in a sense, needs to make his break in his own heart from what the issue there really is. Going to the end of the chapter, it's interesting that my question in verse 42 was raised. And Jonathan said to David, go in peace. And what is the implication of that go in peace? It's like if the nation has rejected him, Saul has rejected him, and there's nothing more that David can do now, you see. And now it's, is David unfaithful to Saul by going? Is David being wronged by Goeth? And I think of the words of the Lord Jesus, the Son of Man goeth, as it is written of him. But woe unto that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. In other words, here is David at chapter 20, verse 42, going. And going for what? Well, going to be crowned. And how will he be crowned? And how will the nation now recognize him? And how now will David, who is the anointed king, how will he convince the masses that he is the anointed one? Ought not the Christ to have suffered before he entered his glory? And anyway, I just see, you know, tremendous parallels here. And again, the Lord Jesus coming to that point that he was manifested in Israel and he went about doing good, and how openly and clearly he was rejected, and now being rejected and crying over Jerusalem, the Son of Man goeth. And oh, what a way he went. That he might not only from Israel bring out the believing sheep, but other sheep he had also. And the interesting point again, that Gentiles will now come to the God of Israel through David. Whereas never did any of them, as far as we know, come through Saul. Anyway, these are just thoughts, and you can go on from there and whatever, brother, expand on them.
Our time is running, so we need, if we have any more questions, we'll need them. Otherwise, you're going to be encroaching on the more open session, which is due to follow.
In verse 41, New King James translates that, and they kissed one another, and they wept together, but David more so.
Yes.
Is that your understanding of it?
That is. He wept most. Yeah,
right.
That's how I understand it.
And so, brother over here was talking about the fact that he never said that he loved him, but I see this as an expression of the progressions of David's appreciation for Jonathan, that he's the one that feels it most desperately now. And it's, so I saw it here, not having to wait even further.
Undoubtedly an expression of David's affection for Jonathan. Yes, that's... Two great men, weren't they? They had so much in common.
You know, again, in my mind, I don't know if anybody's in any way following. I don't. But again, in this chapter, this issue of a covenant being made between David and Jonathan. And even, you know, going out into the field, going out into that secret place, you know, having to go. And again, the entrance into the upper room that night in the cover of darkness, you know. The Lord Jesus being there during the day, but every night having to leave Jerusalem. And now, finally, the nation rejecting him and they taking counsel how they might kill him. Here the Lord Jesus sends two of his own into a secret place, as we heard. And he goes into that upper room. And there in that upper room, he makes a covenant with them. It's just amazing. And the implications of that covenant, and it's there in that upper room that he's making the covenant. Now he goes on saying, the Son of Man goeth.
Is that right? Did he
I'm
make
sorry.
A covenant in the upper room?
Well, he established, he tells them on the basis of which the...
there's a cup which is a symbol
yes.
of the blood of the new covenant.
Amen, that's right.
When was the new covenant sealed?
Well, at
the
cross.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, but
right.
he offers it to them there. He offers them the cup of that new, that's what I'm saying. And so here, between David and Jonathan, now David is about to go. And as he goes, a new covenant between David and Jonathan that would seal the posterity of Jonathan in the covenant with David, aside from Saul, aside from Israel. I just, you know, the similarities are just amazing, you know, just amazing. And the beauty of the contrast, too, where in that upper room there was one who would betray him. And yet the beauty that there is that the Saul's court. And in Saul's court, where David's absent, yes. And now David, outside of Saul's court, is establishing a new covenant, as it were, with a Jonathan. And that now Jonathan, well, rather than being the one to betray him in that sense, is the one that comes out to him. You know? It's just beautiful similarities.
Wow. Well, we're due to have our next session in about 23 minutes, so I think it might be... I have no idea what's going to happen in the next session, but if some of you men have got something, then you may want to have a few minutes to yourselves in the interval rather than just race into it. I have to admit I could never just switch it on, but I'd like to finish it now because you do need just that time to... to think. And as Randy made clear when this was announced, the next session is not about the books of Samuel. It's not about David, Jonathan, and Saul. There's no prohibition. You want to talk about David and Jonathan and Saul, you do so. But it's really for anyone who feels they've got something to share, which will be for our good. Because we're in Old Testament text, there is a limited amount to which we can do anything devotional. So this would be an opportunity if someone's got something about the Lord or to encourage us. So back, please, at 5, and if anyone has...